This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. We are living at a time when corporations are so dominant over so many aspects of our lives, especially our work lives. Companies like Uber and Lyft are bringing people on as, quote, independent contractors rather than employees with stable incomes and benefits. So-called right-to-work bills, which directly undermine unions, are being passed in states around the country. Efforts to kill bills raising the minimum wage have been coordinated and effective. In fact, in order to see clearly what corporations are doing to preserve their bottom line at our expense, we have to see the patterns of their state-by-state approach. Those patterns are being exposed in a new book called The 1% Solution. My guest is Gordon Lafer. He is an associate professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. He is the author of The Job Training Charade and formerly served as senior policy advisor to the U.S. Congress. He joins me to discuss his book, The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. Welcome to the program, Gordon.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So when we cover issues that you've written about in your book on our program, it's usually one bill in this state, another kind of bill in another state. We might sometimes focus on the Koch brothers or the impacts of Citizens United. But I think it is definitely time that we saw this all as part of a grand plan, right, by corporations to basically maximize their power. You open your book with a very interesting and very disturbing story in Tennessee in January 2015, when a Republican governor wanted to actually do something in the interest of his own residents and was stopped by the likes of none other than the Koch brothers. Tell us that story and why it's such an important illustration of what corporations are doing on a grander scheme.
Well, I think what's so striking about it is that, you know, people tend to pay attention in politics to personalities. You know, what is Donald Trump doing? What is Governor so-and-so doing? And it's really critical to look behind the personalities, behind the politicians, at who are the big money interests that are really driving things, really determining who's in office and determining what they do in office. And what we've seen over the last decade, especially with unlimited amounts of corporate money in power, is that in politics, is that people used to think, like, there's the Republican Party and then corporations are a component of the Republican Party. What we've seen instead is that the corporate lobbies have gotten more powerful than either of the political parties. And that story in Tennessee was one of the most dramatic instances of that. You had a governor who was super powerful at the height of his power. He'd been reelected with 70% of the vote. He was just elected to be the national chair of the Governors Association. And he wanted to expand Medicaid for his state's population. It would have given health insurance to an additional 200,000 people in Tennessee. He was for it. Republicans controlled both houses of the legislature. They were all for it. The poll said this is going to be good for Republicans. And the Koch brothers organization, Americans for Prosperity, came in, put field organizers in the state, put a lot of money into advertisements, and killed it. And this was one of the most dramatic instances when you think this is not fighting Democrats, it's not fighting liberals, it's not a partisan issue. And there's something where suddenly an outside corporate-funded body is more powerful than all of the elected officials, even when they're all from the same party and they all agree and they're backed by public opinion. That was really striking. And as you said, I think it's scary.
And so, of course, it's not too difficult to get Republicans, or even for that matter, Democrats, to comply with what corporations want, what big moneyed interests want. But when they, despite that, end up making or wanting to make decisions in the interests of their constituents, corporations come down hard, like this case showed, right? So there's myriad ways of simply campaign financing, but then going even toe-to-toe against politicians who might at one point be trying to do the right thing.
That's right. And one of the places we've seen it is that the the gerrymandering of districts has been even more intense at the state level than at the federal level. So there's very few state legislative districts left where the elections are really competitive between one party or another. What that does is it makes the primary election for Republicans be the equivalent of the general election. That really determines who's in office. And that means the corporate lobbies have more power to go to somebody and say, if you don't vote our way, we're going to fund an opponent in the primary and get you out of office. And that happened on a number of critical bills. For instance, Right to Work, which is designed to destroy unions in the private sector. In Michigan, the Senate Majority Leader, who was a Republican, was a moderate Republican, was a kind of pro-labor Republican, and opposed Right to Work. And he was taken into a room with a bunch of big money donors and told, if you don't do what we tell you, this is going to be your last term in office, because we'll pull our money from you and we'll give money to an opponent in the primary. And, you know, most state legislative races you can buy with $100,000, $150,000. So corporate money goes a long way. And it's been very effective, as I said, not just in determining who gets into office, but exerting control over them when they're in office by the threat of primary elections.
And of course, the Supreme Court decision of Citizens United played a big role in freeing or sort of removing some of the final vestiges of controls on campaign financing to enable corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money in elections, right?
That's right. And, you know, most people pay attention to politics in the federal government, including the impact of Citizens United and money. But, you know, the corporate lobbies have moved from the federal government to the states. The federal government is usually deadlocked. I mean, it's often like they can't agree on who to name a post office after, not to mention more substantive laws. But the states are places that have a lot of power over our day-to-day lives. They're places where most Americans are not paying attention at all. Most people don't even know who their state legislator is, and money goes a long way. And for all these reasons, the corporations have used their ability to spend unlimited cash on politics to move a 50-state agenda through the state legislatures that is reshaping our economic lives in a way that is invisible to most people until you bump into it in your own life.
Right. And so from a grand perspective, they have basically managed to push very similar bills in each state. I mean, so rather than trying to do a top-down approach, they're kind of going state by state. We can't have this conversation without talking about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. A lot of good work has been done by the Center for Media and Democracy on ALEC, which until a few years ago really wasn't very well known at all. So how does ALEC serve as a vehicle for corporations to achieve the state-by-state agenda?
Great. So ALEC is the most important vehicle through which corporate interests are coordinated in state legislatures. ALEC has, as its key membership, several hundred of the largest corporations in America and in the world: the Coca-Cola, Facebook, General Motors, the pharmaceutical companies, lots and lots of companies that everybody knows and everybody buys from probably have been members of ALEC. The way it works is this. About a quarter of all state legislators in America are members of ALEC. They pay $50 a year in dues. All the rest of the money is paid by the big corporations. They meet several times a year in committees where the committees are made up half of state legislators and half of corporate lobbyists. And they sit in those committees and write model legislation that then has to be approved by an all-corporate board. And then those bills are introduced in cookie-cutter fashion in state after state after state. And then the same corporations that write the laws contribute to those candidates' campaigns, run their own what's called independent expenditure and political spending, their own ads, their own issue ads or ads for candidates. And they also fund think tanks in all the states that are affiliated with ALEC that produce white papers and, you know, people to go on TV and stuff like that. So it's a very well-funded, well-coordinated 50-state campaign. And this is why you see the same bill showing up in state after state. And,
you how identical are the bills we're talking about here? I mean, have you been able to compare the copy of the drafts of bills in completely different states and find that they're using the same language? I mean, they're just cut and paste?
In some places, it's exactly like that. In fact, there was one study, I don't know if everybody knows this, but, you know, professors at universities have certain software to tell if students have plagiarized that does searches. So there was a study that used that software that's normally used for plagiarism to compare legislation and found a lot of just cut and pasted language. And in a couple of cases, legislators were a little sloppy. And it said, you know, we, the people of Alabama, except it was introduced in Tennessee. You know,
they my goodness.
But, you know, in other cases, Alec, I think, is smart and sophisticated. And they try to figure out how ambitious can they be in any given state. So, for instance, their goal is for there to be no minimum wage at all. So there are some states where they can, where they'll put forth a bill that says abolish the minimum wage, the state minimum wage. In other places where they don't think they can get that, they'll say, well, just don't have the minimum wage indexed to inflation, or make an exception for people under the age of 21. So it is cookie cutter, but they're also sophisticated. Like, they're trying to push as far as they can get in the direction they want, which is essentially making the corporations richer and everybody else worse off. But they know that it's going to be different in different states, and they have different versions of the same thing to make that possible.
So they study the specific conditions in each state to cast the bills in slightly unique ways?
Well, they have multiple versions of the bill, and they have a state chairperson in each state who is usually one of the legislative leaders who is responsible for figuring out, you know, how radical a bill can they pass in this session in this state.
Is the main goal of ALEC to basically exacerbate income inequality so that money flows upwards, or is it just a broad conservative agenda? For example, we know that the so-called Stand Your Ground bills were something that ALEC pushed, and this is an issue of gun violence. So how can we make sense of what it is that ALEC really wants?
It's a great question. I think it's very important to separate ideology from interests. And, you know, there's a lot of attention, again, paid to big individual donors, Sheldon Adelson or whoever else. And with individuals, you can have personal idiosyncrasies or ideology. But when we look at ALEC, which is several hundred of the biggest corporations in America, these are not individuals and they're not driven by ideology. At some point in every one of those companies, there was a meeting of the executive committee or the government affairs committee, and they decided it is in our rational interest to put money, time, and energy into backing the agenda of ALEC. So when you look at something like Stand Your Ground was pushed largely by the National Rifle Association, which, again, although the NRA has, you know, many, many, many rank and file members, its political agenda is dominated not by the members, but by the gun manufacturers. They wanted Stand Your Ground because they make money off of gun sales. We look at anti-immigrant legislation, the harshest anti-immigrant criminalizing immigration was passed by ALEC with the backing of the private prison industry, because they want, their goals are to lock up more undocumented immigrants and also to make it harder to get parole because they're in the business of filling up beds. So we have to understand that this is not ideology. This is economic interest. Some of it is very directly tied to a particular company's bottom line. So like Coca-Cola is a member of ALEC, they lobby against restrictions on sugary soft drinks. Tech companies are members and they lobby against cities being able to provide free broadband internet to their citizens. But there's also things that look more like class interests, like cutting unemployment insurance benefits or defunding education, where we have to understand these are interests that the biggest, most powerful political actors in the country, which are the big corporate lobbies, have decided meet their self-interest and not think of it as some wacky ideology, but try to figure out why do they think it's in their self-interest and how can we stop that?
Now, we talked about minimum wage laws. Let's focus for a minute on laws that undermine unions, particularly insidious are the so-called right to work laws that are passed and that many states now have. And of course, the title of these laws are so insidious, so Orwellian. You know, who would be against the right to work? So why is ALEC interested? Why are corporations interested in these so-called right to work bills? And how effective have they been?
Well, they've been quite effective at passing them. I think they've been quite effective at fooling a lot of people into what the bills are really about. I mean, as you said, right to work, unfortunately, has nothing to do with having a right to a job if you're willing and able to work. And it has nothing to do with being forced to be a member of a union or to pay dues to political causes you don't support. The only thing the law allows now is that if both employees and employer agree you can sign a union contract, which includes a requirement that everybody who benefits from the terms of the union contract has to pay their fair share of the cost of negotiating that contract and enforcing it. So on national average, if you take two people who work in the same occupation, same industry, same age, same education, and one has a union and the other does not, the person with the union gets about 15% higher wages and has a 20 to 25% better chance of getting health insurance or pension through their job. So when somebody decides they don't want to pay dues, they don't get paid the non-union rate. They still get all the benefits of the union contract. And if they get in trouble, like they're supposed to get $1 an hour extra for working the graveyard shift and they don't get it, the union is still required by law to represent them and even to provide them a lawyer for free if they would do that for a dues-paying member. So it's the only situation where you have an organization that is required by law to provide all of its benefits for free, but is banned from charging for the cost of providing those. And I was in the testified on this bill in Indiana, and there was the Chamber of Commerce was there, and there was a legislator who asked the Chamber of Commerce, would you, the Chamber of Commerce, agree to provide all of your benefits for free to any business in Indiana without being able to require that they pay membership dues? And they said, absolutely not, because we'd go out of business. So that is the goal of
that. Is the goal to get unions to basically fall apart and implode because there's not enough money.
That's right.
How successful have they been? How many states now have right to work bills?
I believe it's...
Is it a majority at least?
It is absolutely a majority.
Wow.
And there are six states. You know, the right to work, most of the right to work laws were passed in the 1940s or 1950s, and it was kind of a dead issue until Citizens United. There are six new states that have passed right to work since Citizens United, because this really made a sea change in state politics by having this flood of corporate money come in.
So we've talked about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, but you just brought up the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Is this another institution that pushes, and this is the more traditionally known institution that does so, right, that pushes corporate agendas?
That's right. I mean, the big actor, I mean, everything is, most things are coordinated through ALEC. So the Chamber of Commerce is also a member of ALEC, as is the Koch Industries. But the big corporate lobbies in America are the Chamber of Commerce, the National Federation of Independent Business, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Koch Brothers Americans for Prosperity, and then many industry associations, the Restaurant Association and things like that. All of them have been involved in this. And I think one of the key things is there's been a lot of attention to attacks on unions, which are important. But the same organizations, you know, when they attack public employee unions, for instance, they try to make you believe that they're attacking public employee unions because they're standing up for hardworking non-union taxpayers in the private sector. When you look at what are they actually doing for hardworking non-union taxpayers in the private sector, they are trying in every way possible to both to have less money in workers' pockets and also less rights on workers' behalf. So they're trying to lower the minimum wage, to do away with a right to paid sick leave, to do away with a right to fair scheduling, to radically restrict eligibility for unemployment insurance, to make it easier for companies to say, oh, you're not an employee, you're an independent contractor, and therefore you have no right to overtime or OSHA protections or health insurance or pension or anything like that. They're trying to expand the use both of foreign guest workers and of teenagers to replace adult labor with cheaper labor. They're trying to make it harder to recover on wage theft when money is just money that everybody agrees somebody has earned is stolen out of their paycheck by their employer. So in almost every way they can, when you put together the pieces, it looks like a massive, well-coordinated agenda that almost nobody is paying attention to, but in every way possible is going to make the rich richer, make everybody else worse off, and make it harder to fight that inequality by taking away not only money, but also rights from the vast majority of normal working people in the country.
Gordon, for skeptics listening to you, they might want to dismiss what you're saying as some grand conspiracy theory. How could there be so much coordination to achieve these things you're talking about? You know, an army of people that are well-funded, coordinating to make these things happen. It's just too much of a conspiracy sounding thing. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, we know a lot. You know, part of the reason that we know about ALEC is that In 2010, there was a whistleblower who turned over many thousands of documents to the Center on Media and Democracy, who published them all. So we know a lot about what goes on inside ALEC because of that. We know that they write bills that come out in every state. You can track, I mean, there's a lot of secret money now that you can't track, but you can track a lot of what they're doing. What my book has done is tracked all of the bills that have passed in all 50 state legislatures since Citizens United on about 30 different issues that have to do with union and non-union workers, employment, defunding of public services, making taxes more unequal. So you see the pattern. You know that it's funded by these big corporations. You know that they think that it's in their own self-interest. Sometimes you have people saying things that are very straightforward about why they're doing these things. For instance, the attack on public employees, there was a Supreme Court case just before Justice Scalia died that was going to undermine the financial viability of public sector unions. And one of the big corporate lobbies, the National Federation of Independent Business, sent a memo out to its members saying, well, you might wonder why we're helping to weigh in on the Supreme Court case that's about public employee unions, because after all, we're private sector employers. And they explained the problem is that public sector unions fund things like minimum wage increases and campaigns for right to sick leave that affect our employees. So they're really going after public sector unions, not because of the public sector, but because of the fact that those unions help non-union workers in the private sector. So I don't think it's all one smoke-filled conspiracy room, but it's pretty clear what's going on when you pull all the pieces together.
Let's talk about how the Supreme Court has basically become an institution that has tended to weigh in on these sorts of issues. I mean, the Citizens United decision is the biggest example, the clearest example of this. It was the court that chose to take up a case and made this ruling that unleashed this money. Today we see the Supreme Court, the newest Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, having been essentially handpicked by conservatives to ensure that a conservative majority remains on an institution that's supposed to be impartial, that's supposed to interpret the Constitution and ensure that laws are complying with the Constitution. Has this conspiracy extended to have these corporate interests extended to the Supreme Court? Because how do we undo Citizens United now with Gorsuch on the court?
I think it's very hard to undo. And I would say part of what is daunting is that Citizens United and a number of other things are opposed by a bipartisan majority of Americans. I mean, a majority of Americans in both political parties are against, like, think that corporations are not people and Citizens United should be overturned. A majority of both Republicans and Democrats support raising the minimum wage, support a right to paid sick leave, and a number of other things. And so the corporate lobbies are now not just trying to pass their laws, but in a way trying to shrink Democratic control and put more and more of the economy beyond Democratic control. Citizens United was a key piece of that, but I think we also need to recognize that the Trump administration is its own creature, and in some ways is different from the normal corporate agenda. But the Republican majorities in both the Senate and the House of Representatives were elected with the backing of the same corporate lobbies that we've been watching in the state. So when we see a unified Republican government at the federal level, and you want to know what should we expect them to do, the answer to that question is in the track record of what they've been doing in the states.
And I'm so glad you brought Trump up, because we are so fixated since last November on the federal branch of government and on this one particular eccentric and dangerous personality who has brought other dangerous personalities and pro-corporate people into the White House. Meanwhile, the agenda that's playing out at the state-by-state level continues and far predates Trump, right? I mean, have we been ignoring what's happening at the state level to our detriment?
Absolutely. And, you know, I understand why people are fixated on President Trump and the federal government, but states have a tremendous amount of power. Even things that are federally funded are usually decided. Who gets the money and under what conditions are decided by the states. Education funding is decided by the states. Healthcare is decided by the states. Unemployment insurance, minimum wage, many, many things are decided by the states. And for most people, it may be overwhelming, but the problem is There was a study, a guy named Marty Gillens, who is a political scientist at Princeton, did a study a few years ago where he compared how do Congress people and senators at the federal government make decisions about policy compared with what does the population think at different income levels. And his big conclusion was that only the richest 10% of people matter. When there's an issue where the bottom 90% of Americans think one thing and the richest 10% think something else, the politicians vote with the richest 10%. He said the only time that that's less true is when people are really paying attention to a certain issue, which mostly happens in presidential election years. So if that's true at the federal government, you get to the state government where three quarters of Americans can't name who their state legislator is, and a majority don't even know which party is the majority party in power in their state. There's almost no accountability, except for labor unions and a few, you know, lefty do-gooder advocates. Nobody's paying attention. And they've been able to move this 50-state agenda in a way that transforms our lives without anybody paying attention. So I think it's critical to not be fixated on the circus and the drama of what's going on in the White House, not to say that's not important, but while everybody's looking over there, just in the first few months of this year, Iowa passed radical, radical laws, Missouri passed a set of radical laws, and these transform people's everyday lives, but nobody's watching it.
So finally then, Gordon, as corporations have seen that a state-by-state strategy can benefit them better than a federal strategy, isn't this the perfect opening for grassroots activists to come in and realize that a state-by-state grassroots resistance is what's going to be most effective? And it's much easier for people, you know, living in California to lobby their California representatives or whatever state they live in rather than having to fly to DC, right?
I think that's absolutely true. I think the other lesson is that there is much greater, much broader support on an issue-by-issue basis than there is for candidates or even political parties. And in places where people have the right to vote on a specific issue by ballot initiative, we've seen, for instance, last fall, Arizona voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton, but by a much greater margin voted to raise the state's minimum wage and create a right to paid sick leave, which means hundreds of thousands of people both voted for Donald Trump for president and voted to raise the minimum wage and create a right to paid sick leave. And that same thing is true about people who want small class size for their kids, who want trained teachers, who want decent health insurance. So I think the lesson is that when we organize locally and on a state basis, it's powerful. And when we can organize around issues as opposed to candidates or parties, it's much more powerful.
I'm so glad you said that. Issues as opposed to candidates or parties. And it sadly tends to be a thing that activists fall into, just ordinary Americans fall into, which is to back a candidate because they like what they stand for and their personality, instead of sticking to their issues and demanding that candidates meet them where they are. And it's a classic, I think, a problem with a political dynamic. We misunderstand that political dynamic and how it should work, unfortunately, to our detriment. Well, Gordon, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for writing this very important book.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
My guest is Gordon Lafer, Associate Professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. He is the author of The Job Training Charade. He formerly served as Senior Policy Advisor to the U.S. Congress. We've been talking about his latest book, The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.